So good morning. Everyone's here bright and early, 8:30, to talk about what's new in Windows 8.1 deployment. I'm Mike Niehaus, Senior Product Marketing Manager for the Windows Group. Today we want to talk about really what's changed in deployment, both for Windows 8.1 and for Windows 8. In some cases, there are some new things for 8.1. We'll talk about those. But there's also a fair amount of content that's really the same between 8.0 and 8.1, so you'll see both of those. We're not really going to talk about what's new in Windows 8.1. You've seen bits and pieces of that throughout the week. We haven't been able to yet show everything or tell you about everything. You're starting to see it continue to trickle out with announcements every day. There'll be more talked about at the Build conference in a couple of weeks and at TechEd Europe in a couple of weeks, so it's just the way that the information will get out there. But at least from a deployment perspective, we're not holding back and really keeping you from any of this information. So we'll make sure that we try to get as deep into this as we possibly can. So we want to focus on changes that affect deployment. We want to talk about the lower level deployment tools that support that deployment, things like the ADK and the tools that are included within it. And then the deployment products like MDT and Config Manager that sit on top of those lower level tools. So we'll start off and talk about just nuts and bolts of the operating system and the operating system images. What we've seen as we've gone from Windows 7 to Windows 8 is our images got a little smaller. As we go from 8 to 8.1, they've grown a little bit, but this is still preview code, so that's still subject to change. We don't expect it to change too much. Might go down a little, might go up a little, but overall we expect images of 8.1 to be very close to the size of Windows 8. Installation time right now is about the same as what you would run into with Windows 8. We can install it in about 10 minutes for the x86 version. Takes a few more minutes for X64, primarily because the X64 images themselves are bigger. As far as upgrades go, we have made improvements to the upgrade process, even over the 7 to 8 upgrade. Now going from 8 to 8.1, we can still complete that upgrade in less than 20 minutes. If you do it on a really fast machine like these Lenovo ThinkPad Carbon X1s, we can do it in about 10 to 11 minutes. So the upgrade time is certainly faster than it was in the past, where it literally took hours to upgrade the operating system. Now we can do it very quickly. It's still going to be a big choice for you to make, though. If you're running Windows 8 today and you want to go to 8.1, how do you want to get there? So we'll provide two different choices. You can do a refresh, which is kind of the traditional operating system deployment, where you use USMT to capture the user state. You completely delete the existing operating system, leaving only the data files, install a new operating system image, reinstall your applications, and then restore all your data and settings using USMT again. That's the process that MDT and Config Manager implement. But you can also do the in-place update. You can take the original Windows media and run Windows Setup, and it will do all of that for you, basically as one operation, where it captures the data, settings, and applications. It then removes the existing OS, just like the deployment tools would. It installs a brand new operating system image and then restores everything back into that operating system. So it's smart enough to figure out what's part of the OS, what's not part of the OS. Anything that's not part of the OS, it can move off to the side, lay down a new image, and then move everything back. Registry keys, files, folders, everything that it can't identify as part of the original operating system, it can push out of the way while it lays down a new operating system image. So for people coming from Windows 7 or below, going to Windows 8.1, refresh is really the only option, because if you try to do an update, while it can migrate the data and accounts, it won't actually migrate the apps. So, well, if you're going to have to reinstall the apps anyway, you might as well use the traditional OS refresh process that you've used in the past to get to, say, Windows 7. But if you're currently running Windows 8 and you want to go to 8.1, this update process is going to be easier than doing the more traditional refresh process. So it is an option. You can consider both choices, and whichever one you choose will work fine. Now, as far as the other thing tied to the image sizes, the main thing to get out of this would be that the resource requirements aren't going to change. If a machine runs Windows 7, it'll run Windows 8, it'll run Windows 8.1. Memory requirements haven't changed, disk space requirements haven't changed, nothing's really changed. So any existing hardware capable of running Windows 7 will run 8.1 just fine. In fact, it's quite likely that 8.1 will end up using less disk space than Windows 8 and Windows 7 because it will be more aggressive at cleaning up after itself as it gets patched and updated over time. So it wouldn't be surprising if you have a Windows 8 system after you install Windows 8.1 to find the system has more free space than it did before the update. That also means that the update process isn't going to leave behind a Windows.old folder. It's going to clean all of that up as part of the update process, so it's going to be much friendlier on the disk. A lot of that's really driven by the fact that Windows 8 runs on devices that don't necessarily have lots of disk space in them in the first place. There are Atom-based tablets out there that have 32-gig hard drives or 64-gig hard drives. We can't use 20 gig of disk space as part of that update process. So we've optimized the update process to use much less disk space, to the point where right now probably in the 4 to 6 gig range, as long as you have at least 4 to 6 gig of free disk space, we can upgrade the operating system in place from 8.0 to 8.1. So then for the core deployment tools, with Windows 7, we had released the Windows AIK. With Windows 8, we changed that over to a new kit, the Windows Assessment and Deployment Kit, the ADK. Now with Windows 8.1, there'll be a new updated version of the ADK that comes out. Really just incremental updates to the latest tools. So let's kind of walk through that then a little bit. Windows AIK supports deploying Windows 7 primarily. Windows ADK for Windows 8 is what's used primarily with Config Manager 2012 SP1 and MDT 2012 Update 1. It included new versions of PE and USMT. You didn't really want to install that on the same machine as Windows AIK, although in a lot of situations it would actually work. The main thing to keep in mind is that with Windows 8, there's a new hardware requirement. This NXPAE SSE instruction set requirement. So if you were to try to use the Windows ADK or Windows 8 on systems that don't support those processor extensions, which have been around since like the Windows 95 days, then you won't be able to, you won't be able to boot Windows PE 4.0 on them, and you won't be able to install Windows 8 on them. Those machines are fairly hard to purchase these days. They still do exist. There are some very low-end Celeron systems still being sold that don't include that support. But the main thing that people have run into is older versions of VMware also don't include that support. So if you try to use Windows PE 4.0 to deploy to something based on VMware 5.0, won't work. It's time to upgrade to at least 5.1 that adds support for this and works properly. That's something that kind of caught people off guard when they went from, say, Configuration Manager 2012 RTM to Config Manager 2012 SP1, because they didn't expect it to break anything with their existing Windows 7 deployment processes. They found out that it did. So now the Config Manager team is working on an update to allow you to go back and use Windows PE 3.0 from the Windows AIK alongside of the ADK version of Windows PE so that you can support the older hardware for older OSs with the older PE, newer hardware, newer OSs with the new version of Windows PE. Other than that little gotcha with the NX, Windows PE and really all of the tools will be compatible with the different OSs. So We can move forward to the new version of MDT, the new version of Config Manager, the new version of ADK, all of which basically are required updates. We can use those to deploy Windows 8. We can use those to deploy Windows 8.1. We can use those to deploy Windows 7. So when we talk about ADK, it is the successor to Windows AIK. With the 8.1 release, there'll be a new version of Windows PE, Windows PE 5.0. There'll be a new version of USMT as well. And most of the other tools, really just minor updates to them. Windows System Image Manager really won't change. The DISM tool has some new command line options. ImageX is still around, but hasn't really been updated because all of that functionality is being moved into DISM. Minor updates to the App Compat tool, minor updates to all the additional tools that are in the package. Now, I say USMT 6.3 in parentheses because I'm still discussing that one with the USMT team. So we said, okay, we're coming out with a new version of ADK. Windows PE team, what's the version number of this new version of Windows PE? 5.0. All right, I understand that. Previous ADK had 4.0, so this one has 5.0. USMT team, what's the version number of the new version of USMT? Well, they said it's the same as the operating system. Okay, the operating system's 8.1. No, not that version number. The version number of the files in the operating system, which is 6.3. We don't really like that answer because it's a little confusing that we went from USMT the USMT 4.0 to USMT 6.3. Question. Did I have 8.1 on the previous screen? You're right, I did have 8.1. It is 5.0. It's part of ADK 8.1. And actually, you'll never actually see it written out as ADK 8.1. It'll be written out as the Windows ADK for Windows 8.1. So who knows what version we'll end up actually tagging USMT with. 6.3 seems a little illogical, but at least for consistency, hopefully I've numbered it 6.3 all the way through the rest of the slides. So, Windows PE 5.0, the main enhancement that's in the new version is the ability to automatically set scratch space based on the amount of memory in the system. Previously, Windows PE 4.0 would use a 32 meg scratch space, a 32 meg writable RAM disk by default. You could change that through MDT, through Config Manager, to a larger value, which you frequently needed to do as you were deploying larger drivers like NVIDIA drivers. With this change, you wouldn't have to do that anymore. The challenge, though, is you still have an option in MDT that explicitly sets the scratch space. So just because Windows PE supports this new option doesn't mean you'll have an easy way to actually configure this as part of MDT. So we've submitted some DCR requests for that to see if we can get that change put in place so that we can properly support this, where it will set a 32 meg scratch space when there's less than a gig of RAM, or 512 meg scratch space if there's more than a gig of RAM. There is an update as well to the supported amount of RAM in these systems. If you tried to use Windows PE on a 64-bit system that had, I think it was more than 128 gig of RAM, it would only use the first 128 gig. Now it will use up to 4 terabytes of RAM, which is a frightening amount of memory to put in a system. But we had OEMs that wanted to be able to run memory checks against the full amount of memory in the system, so it will now support up to 4 terabytes. For x86 systems, it will support up to 64 gig through PAE extensions. So really only 2 to 3 gig of that is actually going to be usable, but you can access it through other means. There was also profiling support in Windows PE 4 that allowed you to basically run Windows PE against a particular piece of hardware and then optimize Windows PE so that it would only run on that hardware. So you could delete everything else from the Windows PE image that didn't get loaded during that previous boot up that you had profiled. So you could create the smallest possible boot image possible for that hardware. That support, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but as it turned out, very few people ever used it. So it was actually removed in Windows PE 5.0, with most systems not really needing that level of optimization anyway to get the Windows PE image just a few megabytes smaller. So if you're using that, that won't be there in PE 5. Otherwise, everything is exactly the same. There are no additional feature packs in Windows PE 5.0. All the existing ones from 4.0 are still present. That includes .NET Framework 4.5. That includes PowerShell. It would pick up the latest enhancements to PowerShell, the latest commandlets, the latest capabilities of those components, but it won't have any new components beyond the list that's present today. Windows PE 4 and 5 both do support BitLocker pre-provisioning, which enables BitLocker while it's in Windows PE before the operating system has been installed, which is a great time saver during the deployment process because you can turn on BitLocker in a few seconds, apply the OS, encrypting it on the fly, and when the deployment's done, it's fully encrypted, ready to go. All you had to do is add the protectors, and the machine is fully BitLocker enabled at that point. So rather than having to wait a couple of hours at the end of the deployment process where the machine's not really usable while it's being encrypted and all the free disk space disappears, now you can do this up front and not have to worry about that performance hit at the end. There are still challenges running the Windows 7 setup.exe from Windows PE 4.0 and 5.0. That's really never going to change, but with MDT and Config Manager not running setup.exe anymore, or not needing to run setup.exe anymore, we basically worked around the problem just by making sure that we don't run setup.exe. So let's look at this real briefly. So in this case, I have a machine that's running the Windows 8 ADK. So we can tell that just by looking at the version here, 6.2. From here, I can run PowerShell within Windows PE. And I can do things with PowerShell that are somewhat interesting, like get a list of the disks. So all of the disk partitioning, disk formatting, anything that you could do through diskpart.exe, now you can do through PowerShell. So over time, you'll see things shift over to PowerShell. But at this point, it's not going to be used that much for things like MDT or Config Manager. But if you wanted to start using it yourself for your own scripts, for your own utilities, you can certainly do that. So nice to have that available. That does allow you to start the shift away from VBScript and start looking at PowerShell as an alternative. Now, in this case, this is the PE from the ADK for Windows 8. If we look at 8.1, I didn't happen to add PowerShell into this one, so I don't have PowerShell available. If I try to run it, it just tells me it's not there. But we can see the version here, 6.3, that is the version for Windows 8.1. I'm running build 9400 here. It's not a final release. The preview release will be out in a couple of weeks. But really, you won't be able to tell much of a difference. This is the new MDT, MDT 2013, running on top of the new version of Windows PE, the new ADK. It does fully support deploying the new version of Windows 8.1 after I log in. So that's the biggest change that you'll see is added support for the new ADK, the new operating system. This is where things get a little bit more interesting. For USMT, we have different versions of USMT for different scenarios. Depending on the operating system you're coming from and the operating system you're going to, you need to use different versions of USMT. If you're in the Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1 range, you really don't have to worry too much about this. You can use the latest version of USMT and everything will be just fine. If you're still on Windows XP or Windows Vista, though, that gets a little bit more interesting. All the way up through USMT 5 that was released with Windows 8, we've supported Windows XP and Windows Vista as source operating systems for the migration process. So you could capture the user state from older OSs and restore it to Windows 7 or above. But now with the new version of USMT coming out for Windows 8.1 in the new ADK, it won't support Windows XP and Windows Vista as a source operating system. It will only support Windows 7 and above for source and target OSs. So you can migrate from Windows 7 to Windows 8, Windows 7 to Windows 8.1, but you can't go from Windows XP or Windows Vista to 8.1 directly. We're still exploring some ways that we might be able to enable scenarios like that, at least for data migration, but for settings migration, that's not going to be a possibility. So for those that have already migrated to Windows 7, not a big deal. For those that are in the process of migrating to Windows 8, not a big deal. For those that want to go straight from XP to Windows 8.1, it's going to be tough. The challenge with that also is really just time frame. If we release Windows 8.1 like we've talked about later this year, we really want everyone to be off of Windows XP before April 2014 at the end of support. If you wait for Windows 8.1 to be available to do that, the odds of you completing that migration by April 2014 are extremely low because of the amount of time that it takes to deploy large numbers of machines. So hopefully you're already in progress using USMT 5 to go to either Windows 7 or Windows 8 before that Windows XP end of support date. The one change in USMT, the new version 6.3, is added support for Office 2013. It now knows how to capture and restore Office 2013 settings. There is a hotfix available for USMT 5 if you're using the current version for Windows 7 or Windows 8. You can download that from the Download Center now. That's basically just an updated migapp.xml file. Download the file, drop it into the appropriate location for USMT, and now it will know about Office 2013 as well. There's more details on what was added in USMT 5 on the Ask DS blog. You can read through those. The biggest change that you would notice is that the UI, UE, UEL switches now work together much more logically compared to the previous release, where if you tried to use them together, the results that you got usually weren't what you expected. But the new release will handle that much better. The Deployment Image Servicing and Management Tool, DISM, is a command line tool that will eventually replace most of the other command line tools that are being used for imaging and deployment related tasks. With the 8.1 release of this, there's a new option for creating a more compressed recovery image. This is primarily targeted at OEMs, but you could use it yourself as well. You can take a WIM file that is compressed using standard compression. It's mountable. You can mount it. You can inject updates. You can make changes to it. There's standard WIM functionality. With this export image, you can export it in a more compressed format that can't be mounted and can't be manipulated. So it's less flexible, but it's smaller. So OEMs are using this really to make sure that they can still include a full recovery image on the OEM systems that they ship without using as much disk space. Now that gets a little bit more interesting for enterprises. We'll talk a little bit more about the refresh my PC, reset my PC functionality later on. So I'm not sure that that's terribly interesting for most organizations, but it is available as a new option. If you weren't aware, there was a command line option added in DISM with Windows 8 called Start Component Cleanup, where you could tell Windows to delete obsolete component versions that were still in that Windows SXS folder. If you've ever looked at that folder and wondered why it was big and just kept getting bigger as you applied security updates, it's because it would install new versions of components, but it wouldn't get rid of the old versions. You could run DISM /online/start component cleanup, and it would go through and remove older versions of the components, but it would never remove the original version of the components. So let's say you had the original version, you installed a hotfix, you now have version plus one, you installed another version, you now have plus two, then you run component cleanup, it'll get rid of plus one, but it won't get rid of the original RTM. With 8.1, they've added a new switch called reset base. Reset base will also get rid of the original RTM component version. So if you run /start component cleanup and /reset base, if you had three versions before, after you'll only have one. So that may be something that you run periodically on already deployed systems. It's probably something that you would want to run on your master images to make sure that you get rid of those extra versions, as long as you don't ever intend to uninstall the hotfixes, so you can then deploy with the smallest possible image size. The Windows 8 release of DISM added a lot of functionality around imaging, so you could use DISM in place of ImageX to capture images, apply images, get information about images, mount images, create VHDs, mount VHDs. All of that functionality was added into DISM. They also added some PowerShell commandlets to do some of the DISM operations. With Windows 8.1, there are more commandlets added in. So over time, a lot of the DISM.exe functions will also be available through PowerShell commandlets. PowerShell commandlets generally are a little more friendly because you can do tab completion and they're easier to type out. But if you want to continue to use the command line executable, that's a potentially doable as well. The other item that was added in Windows 8 is you can use DISM for application provisioning and installation. So if you went to my session yesterday afternoon talking about line of business app deployment for Windows 8, there we would use DISM or the equivalent PowerShell commandlets to install Windows Store apps, to sideload Windows Store apps, to provision Windows Store apps into your Windows 8 image so that they're there when you deploy that. In the ADK, there is a toolkit that used to be available separately called the Windows Performance Toolkit, which is used to gather information about Windows, really all the different event tracing endpoints, hooks that are in the operating system. It can capture that information and display it to you graphically. So it's a tool that's used to figure out at a very low level what is Windows up to. With the Windows Performance Toolkit, you can turn on this tracing, capture that trace information into a file, and then using the Windows Performance Analyzer, look at that graphically and try to figure out, well, why is my system so slow? It's a very nice tool because it's very easy to use. To capture trace information for like a boot up session, you can run xbootmgr.exe. It will set up the machine so that on the next boot, it will automatically capture the trace. When the machine boots back up, you can log in. It'll show a 2-minute countdown so that it continues to monitor while the system is still settling down from the services startup and the things that happen in the background. When you click on the finish, it creates the text file or the data file, which you can then open with the performance analyzer and start to drill in and figure out why is Windows not behaving properly. So this is the type of tool that our Windows Premier field engineers use extensively. They can go to a customer that's complaining about slow startup time, slow logon time, slow GPO processing, whatever the delays you're experiencing are, they'll run this tool and then use the performance analyzer to figure out what's going on. There are several of those Premier Field Engineers here this week giving sessions showing the use of this tool. If you haven't seen those sessions yet, check them out. I think there may still be one yet this week where they really just drill into the types of problems that they've found at customers using this tool. They'll be able to see your startup scripts running. They'll be able to tell what your startup scripts are doing, what files they're trying to access, what they're copying. Are they trying to access a path that doesn't exist? They've seen all kinds of interesting problems through this tool, including companies that have copied gigabytes worth of video files from their startup script and then wondered why it took their computer so long to start up. So it will easily point out that information if you know how to use the tool. There's the biggest challenge is, I see all this information graphically in front of me. Now, what do I do with it? How do I drill in? How do I figure out what's really going on? That one takes a bit of learning to figure out, but it's something that I would encourage you to try out. I did post a blog that kind of walks through how to do that boot trace. Try it once, see what it looks like, get more familiar with it. Even if you can't figure out from the trace yourself exactly what's happening, it is the type of thing where you could pick up the phone, call Microsoft support, say, I'm having a performance problem at boot up. I've got this trace file from the Windows Performance Toolkit. Could you analyze it for me? Sure. Email them the file, FTP them the file, and they can analyze it and tell you what's going on. There's also a set of assessment tools, which is where the A comes from in ADK. These assessment tools are really written for OEMs. They're written for OEMs to be able to run against a lab full of equipment to gather information on really the OEM logo requirements, but those logo requirements are written to make sure that Windows performs properly on the OEM hardware. So it's really designed to have a couple of modes of operation. One is kind of a standalone mode where you could package up a set of tests on media or on a USB key, insert it into a machine, run all of those tests, gather the results as an XML file, and then take that back and analyze it to see what the performance of it was. The other mode of operation is basically setting up a WDS server, adding your images to it, adding drivers, adding everything else to it, and then automatically pushing all of that out to a room full of machines, running all of those tests on all of those machines, and feed all of the data back into a central database, where you compare, analyze, drill in, and make sure that everything is operating optimally. It can identify drivers that are slow to load. It can identify drivers that are missing. It can identify lots of potential challenges with the operation of the hardware. So that's why it's used primarily by OEMs. That's not to say that it couldn't be used by other organizations, but it does have a bit of a learning curve that goes along with it. If you want to, try it out, but we don't see this one being used quite as much by most organizations. Now, we've talked some about BitLocker pre-provisioning. This is probably the biggest thing that happened with the Windows 8 ADK. Of course, it also works with Windows 8.1. The surprising part, though, is this also works with Windows 7. So if you're deploying Windows 7 and using the Windows 8 ADK, you can also do BitLocker pre-provisioning. The way this works is you tell it to encrypt only the use space. And, well, how much use space is there when you're deploying a new computer? There really is none, because this runs right after the disk has been formatted and partitioned. It does require a TPM, so the only way that this can be done is on TPM-enabled systems. Not a big deal there, but pretty easy to do. In fact, if we were to look at something like MDT, or Config Manager for that matter, it's built into the task sequence by default. So as long as you're using MDT 2012 Update 1 or above, or Config Manager 2012 SP1 or above, you'll see in the task sequence steps to do BitLocker pre-provisioning. In this case, in the pre-install phase that runs within Windows PE is a step to enable BitLocker offline. It runs a simple script. You'll see the same thing in a Config Manager task sequence. With the pre-install phase to pre-provision BitLocker. So very easy to do as long as the machine has a TPM, as long as you're using the latest version of Windows PE, so using MDT with the 80K, or using Config Manager 2012 SP1, which requires the 80K. So BitLocker pre-provisioning is pretty easy to do. There's also the ability with the new version of BitLocker in Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 to do an automatic network unlock on trusted networks. So you can set up your machine so that it requires a PIN when it's on an untrusted network and doesn't require a PIN when it's on a trusted network. That is a function of UEFI, which we'll talk about in a little bit. You can have a UEFI system with a WDS server set up to basically hand out certificates to the client machines to certify this is a trusted network. So the machine would trust that certificate being received from the WDS server and as a result bypass the PIN prompt. So you could set that up as a convenience measure. There's also the ability in Windows 8 and above for standard users to change the BitLocker PIN before that required admin rights. With Windows 8 and 8.1, it doesn't anymore. So I mentioned UEFI. There was a session on UEFI that was given by Alfred earlier this week. How many of you went to that session? A few of you? So let's do the super abridged version of that, because UEFI is important overall for Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, especially as you're buying new equipment. There's basically two benefits of UEFI. One is speed, and the second is security. From a speed perspective, it's all about improving the startup time. So when you hit the power button until the time the operating system starts to load, that amount of time is mandated by the Windows 8 logo requirements so that it must complete in less than 2 seconds for systems that have an SSD disk. If they have an SSD disk and a TPM, I think it's 2.2 seconds or 2.3 seconds or something like that. But still, they initialize very fast. After they've initialized, then they will boot very quickly as well, because they don't need to read small chunks of files from the hard drive using the old Interrupt 13 BIOS, 16-bit BIOS calls like have been around on PCs since the 1980s. Now they can use UEFI large buffered IOs to read the OS from disk faster, so the operating system can be pulled into memory at a much higher speed. It also affects resume from hibernation. So putting the machine into hibernation, Windows is writing all of that out using 32-bit or 64-bit code. It can use large buffered IOs, no problem. But when it wanted to read all of that back in again, it was back to using Interrupt 13 calls, reading it small chunks at a time. With UEFI systems, again, it's back to large buffered IOs to resume from hibernation. So from a performance perspective, UEFI helps with the boot up process, the power on self-test, and resume from hibernation. After the OS is up and running, UEFI really has no impact. It's all about the startup times. In the case of a UEFI system, which I've got two of here actually, what you'll see on these systems is a different disk layout. So if we go into disk management on this system, we'll see a couple of things. First, if we look at the properties, we'll see that this disk is formatted with GUID Partition Table, GPT. That is a requirement for UEFI systems to boot, as opposed to the older disk format called MBR, Master Boot Record. MBR disks have been around for an eternity. The GPT disk format's been around since Windows Server 2003, but as of Windows 8, it's now used with UEFI systems for booting UEFI. The advantages of it are basically that it supports an unlimited number of partitions, should you want to create a large number of partitions on one of these. It also supports boot volumes larger than 2.2 terabytes, in case you want to put a very large disk into your systems. But the main thing for us is that it supports the faster startup. To support UEFI, we need four partitions. We need to have a boot partition, which you can actually see here, labeled as the EFI system partition. It holds the boot files themselves, which aren't very big, so there's not a whole lot of space consumed there. That partition has to be formatted using FAT32 because UEFI only knows how to read FAT32 partitions. Next partition here is a recovery partition, and this recovery partition isn't for full recovery of the operating system. It's really for things like a BitLocker recovery key entry. So if you have a UEFI system where you need to put in a BitLocker recovery key, it will read the necessary files for displaying the screen to enter that recovery key from the WinRE tools partition. If you don't happen to have this partition, maybe you only created three partitions instead of four, and then try to turn on BitLocker, Windows will say, sure, as soon as I shrink the operating system volume and create this partition for you. So it's better to pre-create it just in case you ever want to turn on BitLocker later on. Then we've got the operating system partition, which is a standard NTFS partition, not any different than what you were used to before. But if you remember, I said there were four partitions, and there we only see three. So if we go to a command prompt, actually that's an interesting change in 8.1. There's no command prompt admin option anymore. Now it's PowerShell admin. So they're getting serious about this switch over to PowerShell. So from here, if we run diskpart, I can select disk 0 and list the partitions. Now we can see that there are four of them. The one that you don't see in the disk tool is that reserved partition. It's 128 megabytes of reserved space. So that would be the standard layout that you would create on a UEFI system. If you read through the ADK documentation, it actually talks about a four-partition layout structure and a five-partition layout structure. If you created the fifth partition, the fifth one would be to hold the recovery image, so a full image of the operating system that you could use to restore the machine back to a functioning state. So that's pretty much it from a partitioning perspective. From a startup perspective, let's just time one of these real fast. Let me power this machine off. So I'll shut it down altogether. And I'm not sure you'll actually be able to see this, but the machine's off now. So I'll hit the power button and see how long it takes to get back to the logon screen. So 1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, 1006, 1007, 8, 9, 10, 11, about 11 seconds to get back to the logon screen, where I can then immediately log on to the machine and be functional again. That's the speed of UEFI for posting. That post initially took about 2 seconds. The operating system then could boot in probably about 5, and then the remaining few seconds were just Windows initializing itself to get to the point where I could actually log on to the system. So it's all about very fast startup times. The UEFI startup process has a couple of interesting characteristics to it. The OEMs always wanted to display their bitmap as part of that power on self-test initialization. And now that it only takes 2 seconds for that to complete, they didn't want their bitmap to only be shown for 2 seconds. That wasn't long enough. So now as Windows continues to load, you'll see the spinning wheel indicating that Windows is loading while the OEM logo continues to be displayed by Windows. So it will take the bitmap that was displayed by the power on self-test and continue to display it while the operating system boots, just so the OEM can see their logo on the screen for that entire 8 seconds or so while the operating system is loading. So if you want to actually be able to tell, is this machine booting up using UEFI or not, that can be done just by looking at the startup screen. If you start up a system and you see the Windows logo and a spinning wheel underneath it, you're not using UEFI. If you start up the screen and see the Dell or HP or Lenovo or any other OEM's logo with the spinning wheel, now you're booting using UEFI. That's the normal BIOS boot doesn't display the OEM logo during that process. So we talked about fast startup. From a security perspective, the security benefits are, helps when I push the right button. The security benefits are related to secure boot. So for secure boot, what we basically have is a layer of security on top of UEFI where the firmware can verify the boot files and make sure that no one's tampered with them before it loads the operating system. So we want to make sure that before the OS can defend itself, we've verified that nothing has been compromised. So the operating system boot files load. They immediately load the malware detection capabilities in the operating system. And once that's done, now the OS can defend itself, and UEFI doesn't need to worry about that. So this UEFI secure boot capability is standard on all Windows 8 logo certified hardware. When it comes from the factory with Windows 8 installed on it, that will be enabled by default. If you wanted to put Windows 7 on it or some other operating system that doesn't support secure boot, you would need to go into the firmware settings and turn off secure boot. That's something you can do on all Windows 8 logo certified machines, but it's not something that can be automated. It's something that requires physical presence to do. So you would have to hit the key to go into the firmware setup, find the option to turn off UEFI secure boot, and turn it off. Easy enough to do. Now, from the UEFI perspective, the other thing that we need to talk about is native UEFI versus UEFI compatibility mode. There are actually three different types of UEFI systems. If we multiply it out, we could probably come up with even more, but there are UEFI Class 1 systems, which have been around for quite a few years. So they ran UEFI firmware, but they emulated a BIOS, and you never saw native UEFI. So you've been running UEFI laptops for longer than you realize, and they were these Class 1 systems. Class 2 systems then started to expose the UEFI functionality, but provided a compatibility module. So with the compatibility module, you could run existing operating systems with BIOS emulation, or you could turn on native UEFI and run an operating system via UEFI. That started to happen a couple of years ago with the machines that came out later in the Windows 7 cycle. Now with the Windows 8 logo certified machines, you see primarily Class 2 machines, but you're also starting to see some new Class 3 machines. UEFI Class 3 machines no longer have that BIOS emulation, so you can't boot an operating system without native UEFI support. So why does that matter? Well, you need to keep in mind that Windows 8 is the first operating system for Microsoft that supports native UEFI booting without a compatibility module. So if you buy a Class 3 system and then want to put Windows 7 on it, it's not going to be very easy to do, and it won't be supported in the end result anyway. So what Class 3 systems are out there? There are a few of them. The one that you would probably notice first is a Surface Pro. How many of you picked up a Surface Pro this week? That's impressive. For that price, I would have picked up one too, but they won't let employees get one yet. We had to pay retail. So Surface Pro is a UEFI Class 3 system. It's UEFI native only. It doesn't provide a compatibility module. As a result, you can't run older operating systems on it. That's okay. You just need to also then keep in mind that UEFI doesn't allow cross-platform deployments. So you think, well, it's a Surface machine, it's a Surface Pro. I'd never want to put Windows 7 on it anyway because the touch experience in Windows 7 isn't very good. But maybe I want to put Windows 8 x86 on it instead of Windows 8 x64. Can't do that either. When you're using native UEFI, a 64-bit system can only run a 64-bit OS. An x86 system can only run an x86 OS, but that one makes sense. That's a processor limitation. But for UEFI, it's a UEFI limitation. A native UEFI system, 64-bit, will only run Windows 64-bit. If you had a Class 2 system, one that has BIOS emulation, you could run an x86 OS on an x64 system, but not using native UEFI. You would have to use the compatibility BIOS emulation to boot that x86 system. So you do get the option on a Class 2 system. You don't get the option on a Class 3 system. So pay attention to the hardware that you're getting. Don't be surprised if you get these Class 3 systems in and they won't run an x86 OS. Hopefully most of you have moved on to x64 OSs anyway, and that's not as big of a deal. So that is UEFI in a nutshell. I'm sure there are lots of other little gotchas that you could encounter, but that's the quick summary. If you want more details around that, go back to Alfred's session from earlier this week and watch the recording for that one. The main thing here is really you should get used to UEFI. You should plan to deploy Windows 8 using UEFI. You should plan on deploying Windows 8.1 using UEFI. If you wanted to deploy Windows 7 using UEFI, you could, at least for Class 2 systems, and then you'd be positioned to refresh them to UEFI and Windows 8. But if you're using this on older hardware, things that aren't Windows 8 logo certified, I wouldn't recommend it. I would recommend sticking with the BIOS emulation. There was a new version of UEFI, UEFI 2.3.1. That was the new version that started to be released on Windows 8 logo certified machines. Previous versions, UEFI 2.1, 2.2, were kind of crappy, depending on the machines that you're running, and probably not worth the hassles to turn on. 2.3, 2.3.1, the standard Windows 8 version that's out there now, much better, much easier to use, so definitely I would wait until you have the Windows 8 logo certified machines. They also support Pixie. In the case of the Surface Pros, the initial firmware release didn't support Pixie because we didn't have a USB network adapter that went with it. That was released last month, I believe, with the May firmware updates. You can apply the firmware update, and you'll now get Pixie support from them as well. The biggest challenge then with the UEFI tablets is figuring out what's the magic button presses that I need to use to Pixie boot or start up from media. In the case of the Surface Pro and a lot of the other tablets that we've tried, they tend to use the volume up and down button with the power button. So to get into the firmware setup, it's power up, or volume up, hold that button, and then press power. In the case of booting from Pixie or USB, volume down, hold that button, and then press the power button. I think the Samsung devices tend to be similar to that. The other thing to watch out for, I mentioned as we were going through the partition structure, the partition that it boots from is FAT32. That also means that if you're going to deploy from media, or if you want to boot Windows PE from media, that also must be FAT32. So you can't just format an NTFS USB stick, copy your MDT media onto it, stick it into a UEFI system, and expect it to work. you would have to format it as FAT32, then copy everything to it, and then it would work fine. But there is one limitation with FAT32. It only supports a maximum 4 gigabyte file size. So if you have a WIM file that's larger than 4 gig and try to copy it, you'll get an error back saying the disk is full. Well, it's not really the disk is full. The disk just can't handle a file by that size. So you would have to split it. MDT doesn't provide anything built in to do that splitting. Config Manager does. So if you create media through Config Manager, it will automatically split the image into multiple 4 gigabyte chunks and then merge it back together at deploy time to apply it to the disk. The other thing that you'll notice is, like, if you create a boot CD through MDT or through Config Manager, they actually have two boot sectors on them, one for MBR systems and one for UEFI systems. But when you put that CD into a UEFI machine, you may actually see two entries for the CD on the boot menu. Do you want to boot using UEFI? Do you want to boot using MBR? If you boot using MBR, you won't be able to install the OS using UEFI. You must boot using UEFI to install via UEFI. So pay attention to the boot menus that you get. If you see multiple options, pick the appropriate one. Okay, enough on UEFI. Next item in the list, Windows Store Apps. How many of you went to my Windows Store App sessions? Probably not very many of you because there weren't very many people there. Two out of the room. I think there were maybe 30 people in that session. Maybe it was poor timing, whatever. Maybe I was competing against Mark Rasinovich or something like that. But no one came to listen about Windows Store Apps, so now you had to listen to the abridged version. Basically, these are brand new apps, brand new APIs, brand new packaging mechanism. Windows Store apps are packaged into AppX files. AppX files are effectively zip files. To install a Windows Store app, you download the AppX file, you extract the contents, it gets registered with the OS. When you go through the Windows Store, all of that's done for you. But you can choose to do that yourself. That process is called sideloading. If you install an app from any location other than the Windows Store, that's sideloading an application. That can be done to install an app. Installing an app is a per-user operation. It makes the app available only to that user. So if I install an app for my account, log on for account number 2, it's not going to see that app. It will have to install it again. So each user on the machine has to install the app separately. Provisioning is a separate operation. Provisioning is basically the registration of an app on a system where you say, I want this app to automatically install for every user on the machine. So at their next logon, it will automatically see, oh, there's a new provisioned app, I need to install it for this user. That's actually what happens at the first logon on Windows 8. You probably noticed the animation that says, here are some tips and tricks for using Windows 8. After that, it shows a changing color screen while it's preparing Windows for first use, installing apps. That's what it's doing behind that screen, is installing the provisioned applications. There are 15 of them in box with Windows 8. 8.1 is going to add additional ones on top of that. At first login, all of those get installed so that they're available for the currently logged on user. You can add your own provisioned apps, again, using sideloading. You can add up to 24 of those. Ideally, you would put those in your image. So using MDT or something else as part of your image creation process, you would put these apps into your WIM, sysprep it, capture it, and deploy it. When it gets deployed, user logs in for the first time. Not only do the 15 built-in apps get installed, but all the ones that you've provisioned get installed as well for each user when they log in. So you need to kind of understand the workings of that. There are some specific requirements for sideloading. Windows 8 Enterprise, or 8.1 Enterprise, is automatically enabled for sideloading. Windows 8 Enterprise in a work group, Windows 8 Pro, Windows RT, you had to install a separate sideload product key to enable sideloading. Once sideloading's been enabled, then you can sideload as many apps as you want to install, but you can still only provision up to 24 of them. Question?
Can you
So the question was, are they apps that you've developed yourself, or could they be other third-party apps? They could be either. The main restriction, though, is in order to sideload them, you need to have the AppX file, which is the package, the install files for the application. So if you can contact a vendor and ask them, will you provide me the AppX files for your application, and they give them to you, then yes, you can sideload those applications just like one that you've developed yourself. That is a bit challenging with some vendors because they would just as soon you go out to the Windows Store and install the apps from the Windows Store, then they don't have to worry about the overhead of sending you the install files. But some enterprise vendors will do that. Like if you have an ERP system and they have a whole suite of apps that go along with that, they don't think twice about putting all of those onto a CD that they ship you with the ERP client software. And then you can use that with Config Manager or Windows Intune to sideload those on your systems. Right. So follow-up question is, well, what about the Microsoft apps, especially even the ones built into the operating system? We don't have a good answer for that one yet because you pick up the phone, you call Microsoft support and say, can I get the AppX install files for the inbox applications? No. Can I get the AppX files for Link, Skype, OneNote, or any of the other Microsoft apps in the store? No. So we're working on that. We've got some prototypes of update packages to install the updated inbox apps. We're hoping to get those out in the next couple of months. For the out-of-box apps, still the Microsoft ones that are not available in-box, we're still discussing the best ways of doing that. It's always a trade-off between supportability, whose job is it, all of those process-related challenges that go along with that. So we understand the challenge, but we don't have a good solution for that yet. Okay. We could go into that in much more detail. Question. Oh, that's a good question. Where does an enterprise get a sideload product key from? If you're a software assurance customer, if you have software assurance for Windows, you can log into the Volume License Service Center and search under your product keys for enterprise sideloading, and you'll get the sideload product key from there. That key works like a Mac key. It has a limited number of activations. You can install it once on each machine to permanently enable sideloading on that computer. Eventually, you'll run out of activations. And just like a Mac key, you pick up the phone, you call Microsoft and say, please increase my activation count on this sideload key, and they'll take care of bumping it up again. So it's for a volume license customer that has software assurance for Windows, it's basically unlimited use of this sideload key as much as you want. You can't load it in a KMS server. It does require installation on each computer, just like you would do with a Mac key. So it's not like a KMS activation thing. It's more of a Mac activation thing, which requires internet access and validation with Microsoft and all that good stuff. If you don't have software assurance for Windows, then you would need to acquire a sideload key. They're available for purchase in 100 packs. So you buy one key that has 100 activations. I think it goes for about $30 a key. So if you buy a 100 pack, it would be about $3,000 to enable that for 100 machines. The interesting case then becomes Windows RT devices, like the Surface RT. You don't buy software assurance for Windows RT devices. You buy software assurance for Windows 8 devices. The Windows RT devices are considered companion devices. So as long as your Windows 8 laptop or Windows 8 desktop has a software assurance license, the Windows RT device is a companion to that. You can use that same volume enterprise activation key to enable sideloading on Windows RT. You don't need to purchase a key just for Windows RT if you have software assurance on your main machines. That's kind of the 5-minute summary of what we went through in about 75 minutes in the session. So if you want to get deeper into that, you can go back through the recording for that one. Windows to Go is another interesting technology that was introduced with Windows 8. It basically is a full copy of Windows installed on a USB key. It installs onto the USB key, it boots from the USB key, it's set up so that you can basically carry your entire operating system in your pocket. You can run this on any Windows 7 or above certified computer. If a machine can run Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1, it'll run Windows to Go just fine. It will boot up and run the entire operating system off of that key. It has logic in it that if you accidentally remove the key, it'll suspend the OS until you put it back into the machine again, up to 60 seconds, because after 60 seconds, the assumption is maybe you grabbed the key and ran off to an airplane, and for security purposes, the machine will just turn off. Now, that's not the recommended way to shut down Windows, so the next time you insert it back into the machine, it'll put up a dialogue saying, hey, you didn't remove this USB key properly. Make sure you shut down Windows the next time. So it does have those safeguards in it, but it's nice enough and works well enough that you can actually boot up from Windows to Go, start a video playing, pull the key out, you'll see the video pause, put the key back in again, the video will pick right up where it left off. So, fun to play with. It's also a great way to evaluate new versions of the OS. So you have a machine that's running Windows 7, you want to try out Windows 8 or Windows 8.1. As long as you have a Windows Software Assurance again, because this is a software assurance benefit provided with SA for Windows, you can create these Windows to Go sticks and run them completely standalone to what operating system is currently on the machine. So it won't disturb your existing OS on the machine. It will run the new OS entirely on the USB stick. So I routinely have a Windows 7 machine where I can run Windows 8 from Windows to Go, Windows 8.1 using Windows to Go, and just shuffle between them by rebooting with the appropriate key in or out. These do require a specific USB key that supports being, well, first it has to be performant enough. You don't want to do this on a really cheap USB key that doesn't have the performance to do this because it might overheat and melt. The booting of an operating system from a USB key is not a trivial task, so it requires some higher performance drives. It requires a drive that reports itself as fixed instead of removable. And it does have a certification process. So we'll certify these drives to say that they fully support Windows to Go. There is a website out there that lists all of the certified Windows to Go devices. If you search on Microsoft.com for Windows to Go, you should be able to find that pretty easily. That's pictures of all the currently certified devices. So they're available. They are a little bit more expensive than your traditional USB drive. They're not too bad. I think they're in like the $30 to $80 range for the simplest of them right now. The provisioning process for them, there is a wizard built into Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 Enterprise to do that. There's also a provisioning tool provided as part of Configuration Manager 2012 SP1. You could also run PowerShell scripts to provision them. The provisioning process really isn't anything special. You format and partition the disk as recommended. You then apply the WIM file to the operating system partition on that USB key. You set it up so that it's bootable on both UEFI and non-UEFI systems because it can be used in either, and you're set to go. Maybe you want to put additional automation in there. Maybe you want to inject additional drivers so the key can be used in multiple devices. So there may be some additional work that you want to do with these devices as part of the provisioning, but that's kind of separate from the provisioning process itself. I know there was a couple of other Windows to Go sessions during the week. They would go much more in depth into Windows to Go, how to set them up, some of the other characteristics of these. One of the challenges with Windows to Go and Windows 8 is the Windows Store was turned off by default. And that was really because of a licensing challenge with Windows to Go. Licensing of Windows Store apps was based on the hardware ID. So as you moved a Windows to Go stick from computer to computer, that acquired a new license for each of the apps. And you were only allowed to run an app on five different machines before the licensing would kick in and say, no, you can't run it on a sixth computer. So to avoid that from happening, the Windows Store was turned off by default with Windows to go. There was a policy where you could turn it back on again. With Windows 8.1, that policy will be flipped to enable the Windows Store by default, because we've solved that problem. We'll make sure that the Windows Store will work properly with Windows 8.0, even from Windows to go. Windows 8 also added a hypervisor. So you can now run Hyper-V on the client OS. It does require a 64-bit OS, does require 4 gig of RAM, really, to be useful. It requires hardware-assisted virtualization. Those are really standard requirements. The one thing that was new is it requires second-level address translation, also called SLAT. Although if you look at Intel and AMD documentation, they use different terms for it. I think Intel calls it enhanced page tables, EPT. I don't think they realized that was also like the name of a pregnancy test, but I think we like calling it SLAT better because we can remember SLAT, second-level address translation. So that is required on client OSs to solve a performance issue with machines that run hypervisors and have high-end video cards, which most laptops do these days. Servers don't, so this isn't a problem on servers. So SLAT isn't required on servers unless you're using RemoteFX. But with RemoteFX, again, you're using a high-end video card. So this is all about making sure that the virtual machines perform appropriately on laptop class machines. But it fully supports power management. So even though you have Hyper-V installed, you can put the machine to sleep. All the VMs will sleep. You can hibernate the machine. All the VMs will hibernate. So very well integrated into the OS. The big change with Windows 8.1 is this now supports UEFI as well. So you'll be able to do your UEFI testing within Hyper-V. So we can launch the Hyper-V manager on Windows 8.1. I can say that I want to create a new virtual machine, and I'll get a new choice of a Generation 1 virtual machine or a Generation 2 virtual machine. So what's the difference? Well, Generation 1 virtual machine uses a legacy BIOS. Generation 2 virtual machine uses UEFI. The Generation 2 virtual machine will also use all native devices, no emulated devices. So most people will make the shift over to Generation 2. But for client OSs, it just really makes a good testing environment to run your UEFI deployment processes. So we can set up the Generation 2 machine. And you just see a few different startup options in the settings for those related to the firmware. So fully enabled for UEFI in this new version. One of the other nice things about Hyper-V in both Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 is this is fully PowerShell enabled. So if I run PowerShell, there's a commandlet to create a new VM. If I run it with no parameters, it creates a new machine. Doesn't attach any disk to it because I didn't tell it to attach any disk to it. It didn't attach it to any networks because I didn't tell it to do that either. But very easy to write PowerShell scripts that create virtual machines, turn on virtual machines, attach ISOs to virtual machines. So if you're into automating your deployment image creation or deployment testing, you can do that pretty easily leveraging the PowerShell support built into Hyper-V on Windows 8, 8.1, and Server 2012 and above. Refresh and reset your PCs. These are the new successors to WinRE, present in both Windows 8 and Windows 8.1. Basically, they allow you to have a recovery image on the disk, and you can lay that back down over the top of whatever is currently there. So it's kind of a break-fix scenario. When machines ship from an OEM, like the Surface RT, Surface Pro, they will always have a recovery image on them. You can always use these to roll back to the original state of the machine. When you redeploy this as an enterprise, if you deploy a new operating system, this won't be put there by default. You would have to add in steps to do that yourself. The challenge, though, is in the enterprise case, the assumption is the image that you're putting there is fully supported by the hardware that is placed on. So let's say you've followed all of our guidance, you've created a thin image, you don't have any apps in the image, you don't have any drivers in the image, you install all of that at deploy time. And you want to use that image as your recovery image. So someone goes in and does reset your PC. They lay that image down on the system and they reboot it. Has no network driver. Might or might not have a mass storage driver. Doesn't have any video driver, doesn't have any apps, doesn't join the domain, doesn't do any of that stuff. Well, now what are they going to do? They might be left now with a machine that's less functional than the broken one that they tried to refresh to fix. So you can work around that, but it would require putting additional drivers into the recovery image, making sure that you have a fatter image that has the necessary apps, or putting in the hooks to at least try to pull all that stuff back down after the operating system is up and running. It can be done, it just requires more work. So unless you're willing to commit to doing that work, you may not want to set up Windows RE in your enterprise. The other thing that people will try to do is there is a command line that you can run to say, take the current operating system and turn it into a recovery image. So capture it, capture a snapshot of it. But that's only supported if the machine has never gone through UBI, never been specialized. If the machine's already booted into that operating system and you want to then turn it into a recovery WIM, that's not actually supported. So that's another challenge with it. The third challenge then is, well, it gets stale over time because it's not getting patched, it's not getting updated. So most of the time you're better off having a break fix process that involves reloading the operating system over the network using Pixi, using media, using some other mechanism instead. Slates and tablets can be fun. If you saw the suitcase that I've been carrying around this week, I now routinely carry USB keyboards, USB network adapters, USB mouse, USB hubs, lots of additional devices so that I can plug them into these tablets and deploy an operating system to them. They don't have an on-screen keyboard inside of Windows PE. They are generally touchscreen only, and most of the time they don't have any built-in wired networking support. Windows PE still doesn't support wireless deployment, even with the new version for 8.1. So you may need to have a toolkit to enable these. As we mentioned before, you need to know what keystrokes to press in order to get them to boot from USB or via Pixi. So there are some interesting challenges that you'll run into, plus the fact that all of these, well, most of them will use UEFI as well, so you need to be introduced to UEFI at the same time. Disk partitioning, yes, disk part will eventually go away, but for now it continues to be supported. There is new PowerShell support, so don't worry too much about that one yet. We can install roles and features using DISM and a variety of other mechanisms. Great, we won't worry too much about that. We do want to talk a little bit about MDT. How many of you went to the MDT session on Monday? A decent number. Well, in that one, we talked about the new version. MDT 2013 will be released to support Windows 8.1 and Windows Server 2012 R2. It will also support Config Manager 2012 R2 and the new ADK. But it won't support XP and Vista anymore. If you want to deploy Windows XP and Windows Vista, you'll want to continue to use MDT 2012 Update 1, which will continue to be supported as long as those operating systems are supported, or at least as long as people are still admitting to running those operating systems. For the newest OSs, well, basically MDT 2013 will support deploying Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1. There won't be any significant changes in functionality in MDT 2013. It's primarily to support the new ADK and to support the new operating system. There will also be the new Configuration Manager 2012 R2 release. which will fully support Windows 8.1 OS deployment, Server 2012 R2 deployment, and the new ADK as well. So as part of your planning for deploying 8.1, make sure you update MDT, make sure you upgrade to Config Manager 2012 R2. We want to make sure that those are available when the preview release of 8.1 comes out. So you'll see beta releases of both of these with the preview release the same week. And at general availability of 8.1, both of these will be available in RTM versions. So there won't be any delays while you wait for MDT or Config Manager to be out there. So just to wrap up, since we're pretty much out of time, be on the lookout in a couple of weeks with the build conference for the 8.1 preview, which is coming out before the end of the month. We'll also see MDT, ADK, and Config Manager beta releases coming out at the same time. You can sign up on the Connect site for notification for MDT and Config Manager betas. And there's lots of communities out there around OS deployment through MyIT Forum, through the TechNet forums, and we also have a Facebook page if you want to get periodic updates about things related to Windows 8, Windows deployment, and MDT. That's it. Thanks for attending. Fill out your evals, and thanks.